Today we are going to be continuing in Matthew, and as Barry talked about last week when he brought the word, we're in this interesting place at Cornerstone in our Sunday teaching, in that we're approaching Christmas, obviously, which is the time when Jesus was born, but yet for the word, we're in the crucifixion story, and so we're approaching Jesus' crucifixion. And that's the death of Christ. And as the preaching and teaching team got together and we saw this happening, we thought, you know, this could be pretty cool what God might show us, both in the man Jesus on the cross and the baby Jesus in the manger. So we find ourselves in this interesting, I don't know, paradoxical place perhaps this morning again, as we did last week. The idea that we'll be focusing on, which we've been looking at, is how does this baby Jesus in a manger and this man Jesus on the cross reveal to us this theme of the king and his kingdom? And both the baby and the man reveal to us the king and his kingdom, the King Jesus and the kingdom that he rules and reigns in. And just to catch up to where we are in the passage, we're going to be looking at Matthew 27 today, but where we are in the story is that Jesus has been betrayed by Judas, one of his disciples. He has been arrested by the religious leaders. He has been tried by the religious leaders and found guilty. And he was found guilty of staking his claim to a kingship. And clearly we know that he had a right to stake his claim to this kingship. But the religious leaders, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, they use this establishment, Jesus staking his claim to the kingship, as his what he was guilty of. And what he was guilty of was establishing a kingship that was against the kingdom that was in place, which was the Roman Empire. And so when the Pharisees took him to be tried, ultimately crucified, they were saying, hey, look, this guy Jesus is putting himself up against the emperor of Rome. He's establishing his own earthly kingdom, which we know he wasn't actually establishing an earthly kingdom, but that's what the religious leaders wanted Rome to believe. And so so there they find themselves in this place where they're accusing Jesus of establishing an earthly kingdom. Jesus isn't necessarily saying, oh, no, you've got it all wrong. I'm establishing a spiritual kingdom here. Jesus kind of lets things play out. And so so that's where we find ourselves in this story, is that this accusation of Jesus establishing his kingship, which pits him against the Roman kingdom, the Roman king, the emperor, as it will. So that's where we find ourselves. So go ahead and open in Matthew 27. Matthew 27, verse 11, we're going to start in. And here is where we see this trial now playing out within the Roman government. The religious leaders bring Jesus. They say, look, here's this guy who wants to be a king. He's against your kingdom. Clearly that is treason. That is rebellion. What are you going to do about it? Now Jesus was standing before Pilate, the Roman governor. Are you the king of the Jews? The governor asked him. Jesus replied, you have said it. But when the leading priests and the elders made their accusations against him, Jesus remained silent. Don't you hear all these charges they are bringing against you? Pilate demanded. But Jesus made no response to any of the charges, much to the governor's surprise. Now it was the governor's custom each year during Passover celebration to release one prisoner to the crowd, anyone they wanted. This year there was a notorious prisoner, a man named Barabbas. As the crowds gathered before Pilate's house that morning, he asked them, which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Messiah? He knew very well that the religious leaders had arrested Jesus out of envy. Just then, as Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him this message. Leave that innocent man alone. I suffered through a terrible nightmare about him last night. Meanwhile, the leading priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas to be released and for Jesus to be put to death. So the governor asked again, which of these two do you want me to release to you? The crowd shouted back, Barabbas. Pilate responded, then what should I do with Jesus, who is called the Messiah? They shouted back, crucify him. Why? Pilate demanded. What crime has he committed? But the mob roared even louder, crucify him. Pilate saw that he wasn't getting anywhere and that a riot was developing. So he sent for a bowl of water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. The responsibility is yours. And all the people yelled back, we take responsibility for his death, we and our children. So Pilate released Barabbas to them. He ordered Jesus flogged with a lead-tipped whip, then turned him over to the Roman soldiers to be crucified. So here's what I want to focus on in this passage. The religious folk had something that they wanted done. They had a problem that they needed taken care of. However, they didn't have the power to take care of this problem themselves. They did not have the power to kill Jesus. They merely had the desire to kill Jesus. So they didn't have the power to actually kill him. They only had the desire to have him killed. So they had to go someplace for help. They had to work something in their favor. They had to get this done somehow, and they couldn't do it themselves. So where do they go? They go to the government. Now remember, these religious leaders are smart folks, and they had set this whole thing up. They had tried Jesus. They found this very semi-legitimate thing by which they could accuse him of, establishing his own kingdom in the face of the Roman Empire, in the midst of the Roman Empire. And so they go to the government establishment and say, look, this guy wants to establish a kingdom against your government. What are you going to do about it? And so they end up putting Pilate in this really strange place, okay? And it's not unlike the political drama that plays out today. I mean, 2,000 years ago, politics, no different really in some ways than politics today. They back Pilate into an interesting corner. And the scenario plays out, again, like I said, it plays out today. You have the politician who they may see something that should be done. It may be the right thing that needs to be done, but they have these constituents which they need to please, and the constituents are saying something different than what the politician feels should happen. And so the politician's in this weird place. Do they perpetuate their political seat, or do they do what they should do and the right thing? Do they meet the demands of their constituents, or they do what they feel is right for society, right for the community in which they lead? And this is Pilate's problem. He's stuck. He didn't want to execute Jesus. The passage is pretty clear that he didn't see the accusations as being legitimate. If you look in verse 18, he knew the religious leaders' accusations toward Jesus were, I mean, partially legitimate. But in that time, there were these wandering philosopher types that walked around kind of claiming kingship, and nobody really paid much attention to them. And it's likely that Pilate thought of Jesus as one of these people walking around, spouting truth out, but not really anybody that had the power to establish a kingdom. And it says in verse 18 that Pilate knew that they had brought these charges against him out of envy, that was their motivation, not out of a protection for the Roman Empire. And then in verse 19, you know, we see that Pilate's wife sends this message to him, like, don't kill this guy. I had this dream about him, and it's troubling me. Pilate's probably a wise man. He probably wanted to listen to his wife, but he's got a screaming crowd outside telling him not to do that. In verse 21, Pilate asked the crowd for the second time, who do you want me to release? Well, he knows who they want him to release. They want Barabbas because they want Jesus dead. So they want Barabbas released. So he asks again, he asks multiple times just to make sure, because he's really hoping, it seems, that they'll say release Jesus and kill Barabbas. So he's giving them another chance. You know, when you're disciplining your kids sometimes, like, okay, I'm going to give you one more chance to do this kind of thing because you don't really want to punish them because you, for whatever reason. Anyway, I find myself in that place. So he's giving them another chance. Are you sure this is what you want? Because if this is what you want, this is how things are going to play out. So he gives them a second chance. He doesn't want to kill Jesus. And then in verse 24, where he washes his hands of this, and he says, this is on you. I wash my hands of this. It was a symbolic gesture to say, I want nothing to do with what you want because I don't agree with what you want. So it's very clear that Pilate did not want Jesus dead. But he's a politician. He finds himself in a political environment in this moment, and the people are ready to riot, and so he goes through with it. He turns Jesus over to be flogged with a lead-tipped whip, and the crucifixion gets closer. The walk to the cross gets closer. But Pilate had washed his hands, right? But he did it anyway. He was in a tough spot. And he turned it over, the political gears turn, and the religious folk got their way. Now, if you flip up to the John 19, John 19 is another picture of this trial before Pilate. In John, there's some additional information that's not in Matthew that's very interesting. So John chapter 19. Now, the result, obviously, is the same. Jesus gets turned over. But there's some interesting interactions between Pilate and the crowd and Pilate and Jesus. In verse 4, Pilate states very clearly, he says, Pilate went outside again and said to the people, I am going to bring him out to you now, but understand clearly that I find him not guilty. So here, Pilate makes this very clear statement. I find this man not guilty. Again, another sign that, look, what you guys think is going on here with Jesus, I disagree with you. But he turns him over anyway to be killed. And then a little further down in verse 9, Jesus is not behaving like a typical defendant would. Jesus is not defending himself, hence the title defendant. Jesus is the one on trial. He's the one that has to be proven innocent. But he's not doing anything. He says very little during this trial with Pilate. In fact, a lot of what he says is he just agrees with what's being said, or he says things like, if you say that's how it is, then that's how it is. If you say that's how it is, if you're accusing me of being the Son of God, then that's how it is. Okay? Very short statements. He's not, hey, look, you got me confused. I'm establishing a spiritual kingdom. The very spiritual kingdom that you're looking for a Messiah to come and establish. Why would you kill me? I'm not establishing an earthly kingdom. He's not defending himself. He's letting it happen. And this is really bothersome to Pilate. Pilate doesn't know what to do with this because he's used to defendants actually defending themselves. So Pilate has been asking Jesus a few questions, and in verse 9 in chapter 19 in John, he says, he took Jesus back into the headquarters. And I can just imagine him like dragging Jesus, you know, from in front of the crowd into the headquarters, like, look, let's just straighten this out, okay? If you work with me here, we can make this work out the right way. So just answer my questions and let's do this thing, right? So he took Jesus back to the headquarters again and asked him, where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. Why don't you talk to me? Pilate demanded. Don't you realize that I have the power to release you or crucify you? This next verse is just awesome. It just establishes Jesus's authority. And he said, you would have no power over me at all unless it were given to you from above. So Pilate goes to Jesus and says, work with me. I'm in charge here. I can save your life or I can have you crucified. Jesus says, you're not in charge here. All the power that you have in this situation comes from above. His execution, Jesus' execution, is under the authority of his Father. And therefore, because the Father and the Son are in each other, it's under Jesus' authority. Pilate is not the one in control. He has a level of political power in the situation, but it's merely earthly political power. Jesus is in control of what's going down. Now, this is where we see a strong link between the man Jesus and the baby Jesus, okay? The man Jesus, the one going to the cross, the one about to die, and the baby Jesus who was born in a manger. Flip to Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9 in the Old Testament. This is a familiar Christmas passage that we read every year. Churches read it all the time. This is prophecy about Jesus' birth. Now, the context for this in Isaiah, and we'll read the passage in chapter 9 soon, but in Isaiah 8, we're described to us by the prophet Isaiah of what's happening to Israel. Israel is being disobedient. We know how that goes. The Assyrian army wants to crush Israel, take over Israel and the land that they occupy. And so God essentially is saying, my people are being disobedient. I'm releasing the Assyrian army to take Israel. And it's this really doom and gloom picture. And in Isaiah 8, verses 9 and 10, it says this. It says, huddle together, you nations, and be terrified. Listen, all you distant lands, prepare for battle, but you will be crushed. Yes, prepare for battle, but you will be crushed. Call your councils of war, but they will be worthless. Develop your strategies, but they will not succeed, for God is with us. So there's this battle that's going to happen, but it's not going to play out. Like, you can do whatever you want. You're going to be defeated. You're going to be taken captive. And so Isaiah is prophesying to Israel. Like, look, make a choice. Are you with God, or are you with whatever you're choosing to be with here in the world? And if you're choosing to be here in the world, then God is releasing this army, this worldly army, to crush you, okay? But in God's grace, Isaiah presents another picture that's very beautiful, just in chapter 9. We're going to read verses 1 to 7. It says this, nevertheless, that time of darkness and despair will not go on forever. The land of Zebulun and Naphtali will be humbled. But there will be a time in the future when Galilee of the Gentiles, which is Galilee will be in the place where Zebulun and Naphtali will be, okay? So it's the same area, which lies along the road that runs between the Jordan and the sea, will be filled with glory. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. For those who live in a land of deep darkness, a light will shine. You will enlarge the nation of Israel, and its people will rejoice. They will rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, and like warriors dividing the plunder. Now remember, the word was just given, you're going to get crushed. But now you're going to be expanded. There will be a time when you will expand. You will receive God's grace. For you will break the yoke, yoke of their slavery and lift the heavy burden from their shoulders. You will break the oppressor's rod, just as you did when you destroyed the army of Midian. The boots of the warrior and the uniforms bloodstained by war will all be burned. They will be fuel for the fire. For a child is born to us. So all these things, there's this picture of like all this war and death and destruction, and then there's going to be this time of peace and enlargement and expansion and blessing. How? For a child is born to us. That's crazy. I mean, can you imagine hearing that prophecy? For a child will be born. For a child is born to us, and a son is given to us. The government will rest on his shoulders. Okay? Now remember back to our passage. Jesus said, he's ready to go to the cross, and he says, look, I'm in charge here. You don't have the power, Pilate. The only power you have is what comes from my Father. For a child is born to us, a son is given to us. The government will rest on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His government and its peace will never end. He will rule with fairness and justice from the throne of his ancestor David for all eternity. Different picture than the political scene going on at Jesus' crucifixion. Very different political scene. The passionate commitment of the Lord of Heaven's armies will make this happen. So let's look in at verses 6 and 7. Typically when we speak of unborn children, we talk like, you hear mothers or fathers say, oh, I felt that kick. Oh, that was a strong kick. This baby's going to be a soccer player, right? Or, every time we turn on music, the baby moves. This baby is going to be a musical genius. They feel the beat. Maybe a conductor. Maybe first chair in the Boston Symphony. Or the baby does a somersault. You know, oh, I felt a somersault. I think this baby's going to be a gymnast. Yeah, this baby's going to be a gymnast. But with Jesus, no. The government will rest on this child's shoulders. Like, who says that about a kid? Nobody says that about a kid. That would be a hard thing to speak to a kid. I'm pretty sure the governments of the world are going to be submitted to this child. Even if you think that, don't say that to people, okay? Unless God told you to. But this is no ordinary baby. This is no ordinary baby. All right, I need a volunteer. Now there's criteria. Thanks, Jake. Wait till the criteria comes out. You must be male. Okay, good, Jake. You're still in contention here. You must be around 150 pounds or less, and you must not be afraid of heights. Okay, Jake, come on up. Bring two chairs up. I did talk to Jake ahead of time saying, would you be willing to do this if nobody else raises their hand?
I would have raised my hand anyway.
He would have raised his hand anyway. Okay. All right. All right, Jake, hold on. I got to give you something. All right. Okay. Get on my shoulders. I don't know how much weight I can actually support, to be honest with you. We did not practice this. Okay, 150 pounds feels more than what I thought it would feel like. Okay, now, here we go.
Oh my.
You said you weren't afraid of heights.
Nope. I'm
okay.
Afraid of falling to my death.
Okay. Now, you see the picture that's playing out here, if you've been listening to Isaiah 6, right? So, government.
Yes.
Walk over to those flags. Oh, you can't. Oh, let me do it for you. Okay. Government. Hop up and down. Oh, you can't. Well, let me do it for you.
Oh,
government, jump off the stage.
Oh,
no, I'm just kidding. All right, round of applause.
Oh, my God.
Thanks, Shane. I'm assuming that applause is for me. He was just sitting on me, people. All right, this is This is the kind of authority that Jesus has over the government, only he's not wincing. Jesus tells government where to go, what to do. Government can writhe and bend and twist. You know, if you have young children, you put them on your shoulders and they want to go somewhere and they're upset and they want to get down off your shoulders and they can do these crazy positions, but you can hold their legs and keep them there. Jesus has the authority over the government. He takes the authority here, right? He takes the government. He does this with the government. The government doesn't do that without Jesus' seal of approval, okay? More than the governments of the world, and this is a baby, okay? This is a baby that has that kind of authority, right? This is a baby. And more than that kind of authority, Jesus the baby comes, as it says in verse, in verse 7, that his government, so then he establishes his government, and its peace will never end. So it's this never-ending government that's full of peace and justice and righteousness and all the good things, right? So the governments of the world are on his shoulders, and in addition to that, he's established this new government, which is unlike anything the world has ever seen, that is perfect in every way. And we see, when Jesus is born, just this baby king, we see the governments scrambling from the moment that he pops out of Mary's womb. I mean, Herod was freaking out when Jesus was born, and all Jesus was doing was pooping in straw and eating, right? That's what Jesus was doing, and Herod is freaking out. There is a tremendous amount of authority in this child. The moment that he's birthed, his kingdom is established, a child. So Jesus is a baby king who established his kingdom the moment that he was born. But not only that, he was a man king whose kingdom continues upon his death. Like, his kingdom didn't come to an end when he died on the cross at the end of Matthew, right? His kingdom didn't end, it continues. So the question remains, if the governments of the world are on his shoulders and he established his government, why is our world so messed up? Why is our government so messed up? Great question. It's a big question. It's a huge question. It's one of those ageless questions that we'd like to know why God doesn't step into a situation and change it, because it's injustice, because there's so much pain and there's so much suffering. And I don't know. I don't have the answer for that. But I feel like we can have some insight into that. I feel like there's some insight into that. You know, why are so many babies being aborted? Why can't our government solve this? I mean, it's on his shoulders, right? His kingdom, his government rules. Why are there so many babies being aborted? Why aren't the laws of our country different? Welfare. I mean, welfare, whether you're, you know, it's a big issue. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, it's an issue. And it's a governmental issue. Like, why can't we get our hands on this? I mean, Jesus has the government on his shoulders. We should be able to get a grip on this. We complain about our public school systems all the time. No child left behind. Oh, the pressure that it puts on our kids. We're taking God out of the classroom. All of these things that the government is doing. Why does it happen? If he has this much governmental authority. I don't have an answer. I have a complete answer. An incomplete answer. But I know this. When the baby king, the baby Jesus, when he went to the cross as the man king, the man we know as Jesus, his ministry and all the things that we read about Jesus in Scripture, when he went to the cross, he could have stopped it. He could have been with Pilate, and he could have done whatever Jesus could do to stop his crucifixion. He could have done it because he had the authority. He told Pilate. Pilate said, I can save you or I can put you on the cross. And Jesus said, you're wrong. I'm in charge here and I'm going to go to the cross. He could have averted the greatest injustice the world has ever known. He could have taken himself off the cross, and he could have made Pilate and the religious leaders look like fools on top of that, which is, we love that stuff as Americans. Like, we love when the underdog you know, wins and then makes the other people, the mean people, look like morons. Like, we love that stuff. But he didn't do it, and he could have. So if he wasn't even going to use his power within the government, which was on his shoulders, Pilate was riding this man's shoulders to save himself, it opens the door that there's other things that he's going to allow the government to do that he's not going to stop, right? He didn't stop the cross because he loves us, because he loves you. He loved you and me enough to die on the cross in our place, and the cross was built for us. That cross was for us, and Jesus said, no, I'll go there. I will go there. But he didn't just want to save a bunch of sinners from death. He also wanted those sinners to be a part of his redemptive plan. He wanted us to be a part of his redemptive plan. He didn't just want to save a bunch of sinners. He wanted those sinners to be part of his redemptive plan. Folks, why do we bang on government's door to stop abortion? When November rolls around, we pick our political candidates, and so much of the conversation that I hear among Christian, it's based on where this candidate falls when it comes to abortion. Don't get me wrong, I'm in that place with you. I'm in that place. But here's the other side of it. Why doesn't Susquehanna Valley Pregnancy Services see so many volunteers coming through their door in November who want to put an end to abortion? They don't see a rise in volunteers. If you're not familiar with SVPS, it's a life-giving ministry in our community that works with abortion-minded women and helps mothers and fathers parent their children better and all these sorts of things. So they see a lot of abortion-minded women, but they don't see an increase in volunteers in November. And the reason is because a lot of times as Christians, and I'm speaking of the whole church now, not just Cornerstone, we want this problem fixed. We know it's wrong. But we want government to fix it for us. And I have no problem with voting, so we have laws that fix that for us. But let's get in there. Like, Jesus has made us part of his redemptive plan. Like, let's do that. Let's get in there. We're not looking to fix the abortion problem in our country. We're looking for our government to fix the abortion problem in our country because it's easier. It's not as messy for us. The welfare system in our society. Again, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, welfare costs us a lot of money. And in some cases, and in a lot of cases, it robs people of their soul, right? The system robs people of their soul. This wasn't intended. It's a government problem. We want to see it fixed. We want to see it changed. Why doesn't Jesus just fix the problem? The government is on his shoulders. Because he graciously allows us to be part of the answer. Make friends with somebody who is on welfare. Love them like Jesus would have loved the woman at the well, right? Teach her how to shop. Teach her how to work. Teach her how to raise her kids. Teach her how to love her kids. We're now part of his government, right? This baby king came to establish his government. We are change agents as children of God. Like, we are change agents. John 14:12. Go from Isaiah to John 14:12. I'm just going to read one verse there. This is Jesus speaking. Jesus says, I tell you the truth. Anyone who believes in me will do the same works I have done, and even greater works, because I am going to be with my Father. Let me read that again, John 14:12. I tell you the truth. Anyone who believes in me will do the same works I have done, and even greater works, because I'm going to be with my Father. So Jesus is commissioning his people. And he's saying, look, you can do what I've done. You can do these miracles. You can change people's lives. You can make the women at the well in your community see me. I'm going to be with my Father, and my presence is with you. But I have a work for you to do. I have a work for you to do. We have power and authority that is not unlike Jesus' power and authority. Our power and authority trumps that of the worldly government system. We can bring an end to abortion, we can bring an end to the welfare system, we can bring an end to whatever, because we are part of this infant's government that he established. We can have authority over these societal institutions, these sins that permeate our culture. The problem is we don't actually live like it. I don't. We all don't. We dabble in it. We live as if the government is beneath us. We live as if we're riding on the shoulders of the government, right? And we're saying, go over there, change that. You know, like we are out of control because we're riding on the shoulders of the government. But Jesus has control over that. He has control. He had control over it when he went to the cross, and he still let it happen. The Word became flesh and made his home among us. John 1:14. John 1:14. So the Word became human, my translation says, the NLT. The Word, Jesus, the Word became human and made his home among us. He was full of unfailing love and faithfulness, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the Father's one and only Son. And that same Word is still among us. I mean, we have the Word. Jesus' presence is among us. We are in relationship with Jesus. The Word became flesh. We have that same Word to bring to the world that Jesus brought when he was born. The Word became flesh, and the Word still needs to become flesh. We are still called to be in the Word. Jesus has invited us into his government as bringers of his word to a broken world. Let me say that again. Jesus has invited us into his government to be bringers of his word to a broken world. And it's like the Word made flesh again, right? The Word made flesh again in us. We sometimes rail against what's happening in our schools and how the government laws are changing how we do school. School is so different than when I was a kid. The amount of homework that Caleb comes home with, the amount of testing that he has to do, the amount of benchmarks that he has to make just so a school gets funding, and the teachers are under a lot of pressure, and it's a difficult situation. And it's benefiting some, and it's leaving some behind, and it's difficult. But there's a lot of pressure. God's being taken out of the classroom, you know, all these things. Ten commands, we can't say God's name, we can't hardly pledge the flag. There's so many things we can't do in school. But you know what? You could actually get into the school and impact one teacher's life. You could actually get into the school, and you've heard me talk about this before, and impact one kid's life. And that is transformative. That changes the way things go. That changes the governing system. The Pharisees and Sadducees took Jesus to the government to get what they wanted, which was a dead Jesus. And they got what they wanted. It just so happens Jesus was in control. We similarly take our issues to the government to get what we want. We're continually frustrated. Why? Because Jesus has a work for us to do. Because Jesus has a work for us to do. And he wants to move through us. He wants to move through us. And yes, the government is resting on his shoulders, and he hasn't thrown it off and done away with it yet. It's still there. Jesus is still in control. And just like the government killed Jesus on the cross, the government is still doing things that we don't see as fair, as just, as righteous. He wants us to be part of transforming this world. He's given this incredible gift to us, this opening. He didn't just save us from the cross. He wants to be a part of transforming the world with him. And don't get me wrong, like, Scripture is clear about how we treat our government authorities. I'm not talking about rebellion. I'm not talking about dishonoring government or governing authorities. I want abortion laws to change so that there can be more life in our society. I want that. It would make a difference. But we can't miss our invitation to be part of our King's government. Jesus' government, the one that it talks about in Isaiah 9:7, Jesus' government, his government, the one that is righteous and fair and just, it exists. It's real. It's really, truly real. And we forget that. We forget that a lot. I forget that a lot. When the Word became flesh, we were invited to become part of that government. When the Word became flesh, we were invited to be part of that government. We were invited to rule in this world. John 14:12. You will do even greater works than me. We were invited to rule in this world, to change the world by loving the world the way that Jesus did. He loved the world by going to the cross. He loved the world by speaking truth. He loved the world by talking to the woman at the well. We are called to love the same way that our Messiah did and continues to love it at this point. Worship team, you guys can come on up. While the worship team's getting ready, I wanted to read this quote from Philip Yancey. Go ahead and open up your bulletins to the back. back page says thoughts from the sermon. This is from a book called The Jesus I Never Knew. Great book. I'd recommend it. Ben Bernard actually sent this to me a week ago, and it was so fitting to where we are at Cornerstone with the birth and the death of Christ, as well as this whole theme of the King and his kingdom. It says this. Just follow along as I read it. Really listen to these words. It says, when the Jesuit missionary Matteo Ricci went to China in the 16th century, he brought along religious art to illustrate the Christian story. The Chinese readily adopted portraits of the Virgin Mary holding her child. But when he produced paintings of the crucifixion and tried to explain that the godchild had grown up only to be executed, the audience reacted with revulsion and horror. They much preferred the Virgin, and insisted on worshiping her rather than the crucified God. As I thumbed through my stack of Christmas cards, I realized that we in Christian countries do much the same thing. We observe a mellow, domesticated holiday purged of any hint of scandal. Above all, we purge from it any reminder of how the story that began at Bethlehem turned out at Calvary. In the birth stories of Luke and Matthew, only one person seems to grasp the mysterious nature of what God has set in motion, the old man Simeon. You may or may not recognize that name. Who recognized the baby as the Messiah, instinctively understood that conflict would surely follow. This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel and to be a sign that will be spoken against, he said, and then made the prediction that a sword would pierce Mary's own soul. Somehow Simeon sensed that though on the surface little had changed, underneath everything had changed. A new force had arrived to undermine the world's powers. At first, Jesus hardly seemed a threat to those powers. He was born under Caesar Augustus at a time when hope wafted through the Roman Empire. It was Augustus who first borrowed the Greek word for gospel or good news and applied it as a label for the new world order represented by his reign. His enlightened and stable regime, many believed, would last forever, a final solution to the problem of government. Meanwhile, in an obscure corner of Augustus's empire, the birth of a baby named Jesus was barely noticed by chroniclers of the day. Jesus' biographers would also borrow the word gospel, proclaiming a different kind of new world order altogether. They would mention Augustus only once, a passing reference to set the date of a census that ensured Jesus would be born in Bethlehem. So we can see that picture of that baby born and that man who died on the cross and that deep connection and how we can't forget that story. We can't isolate Jesus' death at this time of year. We can't isolate because we see that this government that he calls us into is the very government that was in place when he died. And it's the very government Jesus has called us to place ourselves in the midst of and to be ones who rule with him in authority from above, the authority that Pilate didn't have because he didn't know the truth, but a truth that we do. We don't need to run to the government. We want to influence government in any way that we can, in ways that God has given us influence, yes. We want to vote, yes. That is our right. It is our responsibility. It is our duty. But we can't use that as an excuse to sit back and not engage because Jesus has called us to engage deeply. He called us from the moment that he was born. The Holy Spirit was upon him and had revealed to him that he would not die until he had seen the Lord's Messiah. That day, which is so cool. Like that day came for him. You know, like that day. Like he waited and that day came. That day the Spirit led him to the temple. So when Mary and Joseph came to present the baby Jesus to the Lord as the law required, Simeon was there. He took the child in his arms and praised God, saying, "Sovereign Lord, now let your servant die in peace. As you have promised, I have seen your salvation, which you have prepared for all people. He is a light to reveal God to the nations, and he is the glory of your people Israel." Jesus' parents were amazed at what was being said about him. Then Simeon blessed them, and he said to Mary, the mother's baby, "This child is destined to cause many in Israel to fall, but he will be a joy to many others. He has been sent as a sign from God, but many will oppose him. As a result, the deepest thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your very soul." You get a picture of that birth and that death and the joyous moment that this was, but yet prophesying about who this child would be and what this child's end would be. And I just want to pray this declaration of who Jesus is over our body. These are actually lyrics to a song, which hopefully someday we will sing here at Cornerstone if we can get permission to do it. But I just wanted to read these lyrics, and it states who Jesus is. And honestly, I get really emotional when I hear this song and read this, so if I get emotional, just it's just me getting emotional because of what these words mean. So, who is there in all the earth like you? You're the Lion of Judah. You're the Ancient of Days. You're the rock that breaks the nations. You are the one and only way. You're the hope of the nations, the soon and coming King. You're the one who sits on the throne. You're the Lord of everything. You're the fairest of 10,000. You're the truth that sets us free. You're the healer of the broken and the shout of victory. You're the righteous King of justice. You're the bright and morning star. You're the father of the orphan. You're the mender of our hearts. Exalt his name, the name above all names. Cornerstone, this is your King. Like all of this, this isn't a bunch of kings. This is one King, and this is your King. And he invites you into his government to be a bringer of peace and justice to a world that really needs the Word made flesh. So let the declaration of who Jesus is become part of who you are. Amen.